Jimmy Apple, the EMS Avenger. This is EMS Avenger 20 Minutes to Save the World. I've got Dr. Peter Antevi back with me again today. And Dr. Antevi, we need to save the world, and I think we can do it by helping people get over sepsis. And what I want to mention is that we know that there are 350,000 cardiac arrests in the U.S. every year, and that most people won't survive from that. And we have some very progressive resuscitation practices. In fact, some of those practices are called high-performance CPR. There are 350,000 deaths from sepsis in the U.S. every year, and 1.7 million cases of sepsis in the U.S. every year. It is infinitely more survivable than cardiac arrest. But we don't have high-performance sepsis care. We don't have EMS personnel running SIMS every day. We don't have these scenarios where we are drilling and drilling and drilling over sepsis care. We don't have massive awareness campaigns or sepsis academies for EMS personnel, yet they are far more likely to run a sepsis call on any given day than they are a cardiac arrest. So what gives?
I have a theory on this. And the theory is that when you have a patient who, let's say, tachycardic, hypotensive in the back of your ambulance, and you know, the patient's talking to you and they kind of look sick, but, you know, you throw an IV in them and you kind of let the bag hang and, you know, they're hypotensive, but, you know, you're close enough to the hospital, not going to give any pressors because the hospital's right there. You drop off the patient and you leave, right? That patient's dead 48 hours later. 72 hours later, something like that. So there's a disconnect between what you're seeing and what ultimately happens with that patient. And once you kind of bridge that gap and you start to say, wait a minute, we know the data, you just mentioned it. There's a whole lot more sepsis case you'll ever see in your career than you'll ever see cardiac arrest. And then the other part of the problem is that when you look at surviving sepsis and all these national campaigns, do a search for the word emergency medical services. It doesn't exist. They don't think we exist. They don't understand the power of EMS in affecting change in sepsis. So that's number one. And then there's a lot of studies out there, and I'm gonna point to one of them, which is really frustrating. Back in 2015, it's called the FEAST trial. Kate Maitland, a prominent physician, did a study on sepsis, quote unquote, in sub-Saharan Africa, where the kids weren't really septic. They were anemic from malaria and dengue. And she gave all those anemic kids fluids. And when you give anemic kids fluids, they die. And they came out with this thing that giving fluid to septic people is harmful. And that set off a domino effect where Cincinnati put out a paper back in 2019 where only 3% of the children who came in septic shock by EMS, only 3% got one drop at all of saline. And that's because of this concept of you shouldn't be giving people fluids. So there's all these things happening at the same time. And so we have changed the game completely. And we have said EMS is maybe the most important, you know, partner in the sepsis chain of survival.
EMS should be owning sepsis care.
We should own it. And why don't we own it? Because when you go to the hospital and say, hey, we're EMS, we want to be involved in sepsis care, they like lick you off like you're a mosquito. So we have changed it, and we're giving them a lot of abdominal pain. I mean, they're hurting, and why? Because the hospital, they've been forced to do something called the step one bundle. They have to, within a certain time frame, get IV fluids in, get a lactate level, get a blood culture, give antibiotics, and so they're forced to do certain things. Well, we are doing two of those things for you, dear hospital. We're giving fluids. Oh, yeah, but if you give it, we can't get credit for it. Okay, we'll fix that. And now they have fixed that, and now they're so happy. Now we've been giving antibiotics for like 6 years now. And the hospital said, if it didn't come out of our Pyxis, we cannot get credit for your antibiotics. So, right? So now we are actually in the midst of a big study where we have given 1,200 doses of antibiotics just in the last 2 years alone in Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. And now we're hoping to publish that this coming year. There's another big study going on called Pit Stop in Toronto, where they're looking at a randomized controlled trial on pre-hospital antibiotics and IV fluids. Once those data are made available and people start to see that EMS should own sepsis, then maybe we'll have EMS systems addressing it. Maybe we'll have a sepsis academy, like you mentioned. But we have to fix the sepsis problem, and it starts in EMS. Agreed.
Sure. There are so many areas there where I want to add something, and I try to have to order my thoughts here. So first of all, you mentioned the study. Where was the study where they were dealing with Deng and everything else?
With dengue, that was called the FEAST trial, and that's Catherine Maitland is the first author on that, and it was published in the New England Journal, by the way.
We know, even just from the WAKE study that was published, that only half of patients had any sort of fluid going.
That's right.
And I think the recognition issue is a big problem too. I don't think that the
It is.
average boot on the ground has any concept of whether sepsis, whether fluid administration hurts or helps. I think that, they have the generic sense that fluid for everyone anyway. I think it's more about recognition and then the education past the recognition. I know
Yeah.
I've been honing a way to spread awareness using what I call the too gross concept, which is sepsis is too gross. You have a patient who has vital signs that are either too high or too low, too fast or too slow, and they're gross, which is gastroagenda to urinary, respiratory, open sores, and surgeries. If you are thinking about that actively, I think that you will catch a lot more sepsis as a provider.
I love that. I love that. And I think that you have to kind of go into every situation primed to remember to think about that, especially if you're going into a nursing home, a SNF, where you know that that's what's waiting for you when you get in there. And even something as simple as throw on the end tidal. If your end tidal is less than 25, that's a respiratory alkalosis, which is trying to fix a metabolic acidosis. And so we have to kind of teach that concept that an end tidal of less than 25 likely is showing that you have a metabolic acidosis, probably lactic acidosis, likely from sepsis, unless the patient's hemorrhaging, right? That's another reason for having a low end tidal. But there are some quantitative ways of determining whether or not you have sepsis or not beyond the vital signs that you had mentioned. But we have all been fooled by sepsis. I'll raise my hand and I'll say, I have missed sepsis more times than I want to admit. In the ER, we have the patients for hours, right? And 2 hours after the patient's been in your emergency department, you finally see them become hypotensive. You're like, totally missed that one. And when you go back and try and figure out why did I miss it, well, it's because I saw 30 patients with fever and tachycardia, and now this is the one who ends up becoming septic. It's not an easy task. I don't think anyone will ever figure it out perfectly, but I do think that you have to use all the tools you have in your toolbox. But like you said, even better, you have to come in just thinking of the word sepsis, and I think you're ahead of the game already.
Sure. And the thing about sepsis is it's almost like the war on terror. Like, how do you wage war against a concept? Sepsis is so insidious in that you don't often just get the guy that's boiling with a temperature of 105, with a blood pressure of 60 over 40, with an end tidal of 12. It's this guy sitting there who just doesn't quite feel right, maybe actually a little bit cool to the touch, actually may have a relatively normal blood pressure, and you're not quite noticing that they're breathing 22 times a minute at rest. And it's really paying attention to the subtleties. But before I move on from that, you had mentioned the data about kids not getting a drop of fluid. And something that I don't think even people who really are educated on sepsis think about a lot is how big of a problem sepsis is for kids. You think about it as something that just invades nursing homes or people who are already hospitalized. I am in neonatal and pediatric critical care transport. That's what I do full time. And we are always on every call wondering if this kid is septic or not. And it's a much bigger problem than people think.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that. Kids don't have the best immune system, especially the infants. I'll never forget, I had a kid many years ago who was playing football. He slid on some mud. It opened up the skin like a little abrasion. His parents brought it down. I went to the doctor. They kind of said, "Hey, just put some Bactroban on it, no problem." And then by the time he came to me, he was floridly septic. Thank God we saved his life. But today he has no arms and no legs. And that's what the sepsis did to him. Now he has prosthetics, but thank God that kid's alive. But there's a lot of cases every single day in this country where children are dying. You'll never hear about it. I'll never hear about it. It won't be in the paper. The parents are at home crying. They get a divorce. You're blaming the other person. It blows up the entire family unit. And people really have to understand that early care makes a difference and that we have a policy now. I don't care if you're across the street from that hospital, right? Because in that Cincinnati study, and I'll send it to you, it's a great read. Even the kids who were brought in septic shock, it took 33 minutes for them to get that first drop of IV fluid. If you were in the waiting room in that hospital, it took 53 minutes. We're much faster than that. And now, by the way, we started using the LifeFlow, which we use for whole blood. It's basically,
It's a
a
giant
squirt gun,
water
if you
pistol for
will.
blood.
It's a water pistol. But my chief here at Palm Beach Gardens said, "Hey, doc, we're using it for blood. We have all these sepsis patients. So now we're going to be publishing our study. But now, when I look at all my sepsis patients across the board, every one of them is getting a liter or more." And we're looking at our survival, which again, we haven't published yet, but our survival is much higher now that we're giving just fluid. And we just started antibiotics with that agency too. So again, fluid, antibiotics, we're giving lots of push pressure now. And lo and behold, and this is the best part of it, a lot of these patients, by the time they get into the emergency department, they're not even coded as sepsis anymore. Because they're not hypotensive, they're not tachycardic, they look pretty darn good, they're not altered anymore. And so a lot of patients who would have ended up being coded as septic because of what EMS has done, they're not being even called septic anymore, and they're leaving the hospital the next day. This is a major, major point where we got to rise up, EMS has to rise up, take on the sepsis problem. And then finally, those folks at the hospital will finally, maybe in 10 years from now, they'll say, "Hey, guys, thank you so much. You really solved sepsis."
We have to do away with the concept that your proximity to the hospital invalidates a need to perform critical interventions in a sick patient.
Amen.
What people don't consider, we were talking about how insidious sepsis can be, and sometimes it's very subtle. I know that the local hospital that I transported to for quite a while has no real specific sepsis alert. I can get there with a septic patient or a patient that I think is sepsis, and they could sit there for 20 minutes, maybe 30 minutes, maybe more, before they ever start getting fluids from the hospital. So your proximity to the hospital doesn't mean they're getting life-saving interventions faster.
And I mean, we have to stand at the top of the mountain and say that, but not until you actually show your folks, your crews, that data, they won't understand it. Just like when you mentioned the respiratory rate of 22, we now have the health data exchange. So every one of my personnel, after they drop off a patient, can actually see the outcome. And you know how many patients we have caught where the primary impression was respiratory distress. It's because they never rolled the patient over, realized she had a big decubitus ulcer that was all festering with bacteria. And the reason she was breathing fast is because she was septic. And title would have told you that of less than 25. A good physical exam would have told you that. But now we're giving them the full that closure of understanding, and the next time they're not going to miss it. So, I guess I'll stop by saying that EMS is the one specialty in the House of Medicine where we have the worst follow-up, and therefore you cannot improve your clinical practice. The other end of the spectrum are anesthesiologists. They turn the dial, the patient goes out. They turn the dial, the patient wakes back up again. When you have feedback that's very, very robust and very quick, you end up becoming a better clinician. And so as a profession, EMS has to work on that, kind of in general with all patients, but that's what'll make you better at recognizing the next sepsis patient is realizing you just missed the last one.
The cornerstones of our pre-hospital sepsis management, would you say fluid, pressors, antibiotics?
Yes, that's it.
I remember being in
Oxygen.
a oxygen, of course. I remember being in a webinar with you, a sepsis webinar, where you said that fluid is to sepsis as whole blood is to trauma. It is
That's right.
so important to start getting that fluid into that sepsis patient.
I want to double click on that because early fluid. And so what happens in sepsis, you end up getting a lot of leakage in the vessel. So when you talk to an ICU doctor and you say the word fluid, they cringe. Why? Because by the time the patient's in the ICU, all that fluid that's going in is going right out. It's going into the tissues. You have patients who are 9, 10 liters positive on day three in the ICU. On the other hand, if you and EMS are giving that patient early on fluid or in the emergency department fluid, you don't have that leak yet because you don't have all the endotoxins and so forth creating the leak in the vessel. So by the time the ICU gives fluid, the fluids are not working. But that we should not take what's happening in the ICU as a sign for what not to do in EMS. It's exactly the opposite. That's number one. And then the second thing, and we're doing this now new at Palm Beach County Fire, we're now using cold liquid plasma for traumatic brain injury because it fixes the endothelium, that inside of the blood vessel. It also does the same thing during sepsis. It does the same thing during burns. So what the future holds for sepsis is cold liquid plasma, which only costs $60. And I think that's going to be the future. So if you're an EMS and you're giving plasma early, you're giving antibiotics early, you're giving push pressure early, you're going to end up with a whole new bucket of patients who don't even look septic by the time you get into the emergency department, who are going to walk out of the hospital thanking you for what you did for them. And that's why I think that EMS is going to really be very important in sepsis in the future. So please do the right thing. And don't, if you're talking to an ICU doctor about sepsis, it's not the same disease by the time it gets to them. So I would say just ignore them because you're working on totally something different.
You have at your disposal, you can grab either lactated ringers or normal saline. Most of the data is not overwhelming as far as which one has an impact on survival or more of an impact on survival. There's one more recent study that showed that at least in ICU patients, that ringers showed slightly better survival, but when you broke it down into the subgroups, the whole thing kind of fell apart. But something I wanted to mention, and this is also true for DKA patients, is the devil's in the details. What you always see in the studies is that complications were higher with normal saline. Patients suffered from hyperchloremic acidosis. And what I wanted to say was that, but did you die isn't always the best metric. It doesn't feel good to be in a state of metabolic acidosis. Would you say that if you had the choice of one or the other, that ringers would just be the better choice?
The answer is yes, but I'll kind of throw in choice number C, which is plasma, which I think is really the best choice. But here's the problem with ringers. And I see a lot of agencies who have moved to ringers, which is fine. But when you get to PBI, where we know the data shows that TBI is maybe more harmful for the TBI for the patient, for the TBI patient. And now what are we gonna start carrying normal saline for the TBI patient and ringers for the septic patient. So I think that it's probably a wash at the end of the day. I think if you give either of those fluids early, you're making a difference. If you're giving pressors, you're making a difference. But I really do think that what's really going to be a significant improvement in outcomes, I think, will be cold liquid plasma. Or in the future, there's something called freeze-dried plasma, which is now available in Europe. It's available to the military, the US military, but not available in the US for civilians just yet. They're going through FDA approval. That comes like in a what looks like an NTIV bag and it has some crystals in it. And then once you add fluid, you mix it, it becomes cold liquid plasma. That's what I think that's going to take over the world for sepsis patients, burn patients, TBI patients at a minimum. And then we'll use the saline for the patients who really didn't even need the saline to begin with. Hey, we're starting an IV, we're going to give them 500 of fluid just for the ride. But when you really need it, you're going to end up using plasma in the near future.
Another question. If you're a medical director for a service and the only presser that you're allowing your medics is dopamine, should you be marched down the street with someone walking behind you saying, shame, shame, shame?
Yes.
Okay. Norepi is your first line in sepsis almost always. Is that correct?
Yes, however, we try to be careful about carrying like too many medications. And so just because we've always carried epi, we said, we're going to keep it simple, stupid kind of thing. And we use push presser. And then that would be a bridge to norepi when they get to the emergency department. And again, we have short transport time. So we weren't going to carry a whole nother med when we can just kind of, and how we do it. We do push presser, which is, cardiac arrest epi diluted by tenfold, makes it to 1 to 100,000. We give 1 mL, which is 10 mics, every minute or two, just depending on how the patient's doing. And so I mean, that's what we do, but I know lots of agencies who carry other meds, including Levofed. And then another big issue, by the way, which we haven't spoken about, with sepsis, is this blood pressure issue. I think that the blood pressure tools that we have coming out of these machines are horrible. There are now two devices that I'm aware of, because I have one that someone just sent me, and we're going to try and do a study where it's a finger, it's a Velcro cuff around your finger that gives you arterial level blood pressure. Beat to beat blood pressure. So it's about every 10 seconds you get a new blood pressure. And I was on my finger for like 30 minutes the other day, and it was right on the money compared to a manual. And then another guy developed another device where it's around your wrist, also comparable. And not until we have beat to beat blood pressure that doesn't matter if you're moving in the back of an ambulance, which is coming, by the way. That's when I think that you're really going to be able to refine and dial in your sepsis care. And that even when you give that first bolus of fluid through the life flow, you'll see your blood pressure change right on the spot. When you give that first bolus of a unit of blood, your blood pressure changes. It gives you cardiac output, it gives you shock index. Once we have that additional tool, it'll be a game changer in EMS, where we actually have accurate blood pressures that are meaningful, that we don't have to keep pushing a button or doing manual for.
Sure. I actually just did some content on a study, a recent study that demonstrated that NIBP was vastly overestimating hypotension or lower blood pressures in critically ill patients and vastly underestimating hypertension in critically ill patients. So having something that's providing a lot more accuracy there certainly is a game changer, as well as making sure that your providers are looking at the map and not just
Yes.
focusing on the systolic blood pressure.
Well, what people don't realize is that those devices, those machines, all they measure is the map.
Correct.
And then they use a formula to determine SBP and the diastolic blood pressure. And I've been on cases in the field where guy's unconscious, in the nursing home. We push it says 80 over 40. We push it again, it says 160 over 80. What? So we have pulled off all of our NIBP, we pull up all the cuffs from Palm Beach County Fire Rescue. That's how bad it's gotten. And now we force manual. The guys and gals hate us for it, but It is what it is until we find something better. And I think that's right around the corner. I think in the next couple of years, EMS is going to have access to better tools and technology that'll allow the diagnosis of sepsis to happen earlier, to allow us to see what our interventions are doing. I think ultrasound will become more ubiquitous, where you can actually look at the IVC to see if a patient is, needs fluids. Are they responsive to fluids? Again, I really think EMS should open up their own hospital because we're so freaking good at what we do.
The last thing we need to talk about is antibiotics. And I want to refer to an exchange that happened about a year ago. Sal Rezaei fired a shot across your bow on social media over your approach to sepsis or antibiotics and sepsis. And you guys kind of came to a consensus there, but there is some disagreement as to the role of what role EMS has in administering pre-hospital antibiotics. And I think that there a lot of subtlety gets lost, even when discussing some of those studies and even a meta-analysis that shows that survival is actually higher with the administration of antibiotics, but that there is a very patient-centric conversation that has to happen, and that crews need to be highly trained in recognizing the need for antibiotics and not robotically given broad spectrum antibiotics to everyone that even flirted with the word sepsis.
Correct. And right, what you're mentioning here is this whole thing about we only give antibiotics if you're, if you're in shock, right? If you're hypotensive, or you have a lactate and title of less than 25. But I'm definitely right on this one. Okay, I'll take this one to my grave. When you talk to hospital doctors, they get upset. The ER doc and the ICU doc, they get upset that you didn't do a blood culture before you gave the antibiotics. And why? Because they're being forced to get blood cultures prior to antibiotics by CMS, the federal government. So when we are giving antibiotics, it freaks them out, right? That's number one. The second thing is that, yes, we are giving antibiotics, but when you look at the Lancet study that was done in the Netherlands, that was the pre-hospital sepsis study that said antibiotics don't work. That was a total bogus study. And that's what they lean on. It's because in order to get into that study, you didn't have to be hypotensive. You had to have a few of the SIRS criteria, some tachycardia, some tachypnea, a fever. And basically, only 8% of the patients in that study were hypotensive. So, like, they weren't even septic. I should say there was no septic shock there. So, if you give a patient an antibiotic who didn't need it, then it's going to show that the antibiotics don't make a difference. And so I think we have to talk about the same type of patient. And if you're telling me that 40% of patients in septic shock are going to die in the United States today, 40%, and you're worried about getting a blood culture because you want to make sure that you tailor the antibiotic, no, that is completely not the right way of thinking about it. And I think the Toronto study will show it. Our data is going to show it, but again, just to be clear, it's not just the antibiotic that's going to do the difference. It's the fluid, it's the antibiotic, it's the push presser, it's the airway management, it's the recognition to kind of start where you started earlier. It's EMS controlling sepsis and doing everything that the hospital does today, except for doing the lactate, right? That's the one thing we really can't do. That the emergency department can do, and just we can do it, right?
There's
And
plenty of EMS services that are running lactates, aren't there?
no, they're not, because you, in order to run a lactate, you have to have an ISTAT. To have an ISTAT, it's not a CLIA waived test. CLIA is basically a lab regulatory agency. So if you want to run a lab test that requires CLIA, you have to go through and get CLIA approved. So I just went through this and I know I took an 8-hour course. It's a disaster. All for what? So I can carry a $10,000 ISTAT device so it can give me a lactate level. For what? I can do an end tidal. If an end tidal is less than 25, it's a marker for an elevated lactate. And I can see my patient looks pretty bad and they're hypotensive anyway. So we aren't going to spend the money and the time to do that. So we effectively can do everything that the hospital can do except draw blood culture, which we refuse to do. The hospital could buy these new bacterial bottles that actually will take out the antibiotic that's already in the bloodstream. And there are studies that have shown that even patients who have gotten antibiotics in the field, they still have a high proportion of positive cultures in the emergency department. So, and the patients are going to get broad spectrum antibiotics anyway. The only thing it'll lead for the patient, if they live, is it's going to lead them to stay a few more extra days in the hospital because we didn't have the blood culture to tailor the antibiotic regimen. Big deal. They're alive.
Right.
So I wait to be proven wrong. I'll come onto any webinar and I'll debate anyone on this topic, but don't tell me that you're right because you couldn't get a blood culture and it ruined your ability to report back to the federal government. I'm not taking that as an argument.
Something I say in these situations all the time is that the plan is not the goal. The goal is the goal. And the goal is to
That's
save the
right.
patient's life.
That is correct. And if you go, every agency, you all have septic patients. Go back and look at your outcomes on those patients. Let that be your baseline. And then compare it to agencies like mine and agencies like Paul Banerjee in Polk County and other agencies who are doing this, Palm Beach Gardens, fast fluids. Like they're one of the few agencies that are doing not just fluids, but fast fluids. Because if you look at agencies who do the hang the fluids, the average septic patient gets 400 cc's. That's too little, right? You need at least a liter, maybe a liter and a half. And then now you're making an impact on that septic patient. So that's another question that hasn't been answered. And I think that we need to do some more data and look at more data to see if that really makes a difference. That's where I think the money's at. Early fast fluid, early push pressure, early antibiotics, and then the outcomes will be better. We owe it to people to show our outcomes. You can guarantee that I will continue to do that. And we'll look at the RCT that's being done up in Canada by Dr. Chesky's called the Pit Stop Study. That is a study that's going to open people's eyes to what EMF can do in sepsis.
Dr. Grantevi, I appreciate you coming on and talking about sepsis. Maybe in 10 years, EMS will be running HP sepsis academies nationwide.
We should do that today. Thanks so much, Jimmy. Appreciate coming on.
All right, catch you next time.